Hey guys, welcome back to the forum where science comes to socialize, the podcast where we put the societal spin on important scientific issues. My name is Aubrey and I'll be one of your hosts today.
I'm Cleo.
And I'm Daniela. Thanks for joining us. And be sure to communicate with us the best way we know how, on social media, of course.
You'll find our show and many other listeners to chat with on Twitter and Facebook. So be sure to head on over to Twitter and find us at ISGP Forum or check out facebook.com/ISGP Forum. We're happy to take your questions and comments on this episode or any of our 1 million and two others.
Dramatic much?
It just feels like that many sometimes.
That's fair enough. But we do have a bunch of episodes out there, so be sure to check them out. And if you're more interested in some topics over others, like climate change versus infectious disease, you can actually check out our playlists on SoundCloud, which we use to collect similarly themed episodes in one place for ease of listening for you.
So which theme is on the docket today?
Climate change. Well, as the general theme. As you all may know, we've done lots of episodes in the past on climate change impacts, and even a broader one outlining the many causes of climate change. But today, we'll get into the specifics of the heart of the climate change problem, the cause of much controversy, the reason for a lot of public passion.
I know where this is going.
I'm sure you do. That is carbon dioxide emissions.
Wait, now I get the episode title. Like igniting fuel. And a remix of the renewable energy. Oh my God.
Okay, let's settle down, everyone. This topic is a big one, and we'll have some help from a policy position paper written by one of my personal heroes, who I may or may not have gotten a picture with as if he was a bona fide Hollywood celebrity, which I promise was weird for everyone, Dr. Richard Alley, a professor at Penn State University, member of the National Academy of Sciences, and foreign member of the Royal Society.
His paper was titled Large and Long-Lasting Human-Caused Climate Change, and it was discussed at the ISGP conference series called Climate Impact on National Security,
which was held at the U.S. Army War College, which has rules about mobile devices in the strategic leadership building we were at, which made it difficult for me to get my picture. But don't worry, we figured it out, and it is on my Facebook.
Maybe we'll have to post that photo on the forum social media now that you've hyped it up so much.
I would definitely not object to that.
Oh, I know you wouldn't. At least your personal heroes are relevant, though. I don't think our listeners want to see pictures of me with Madison Bumgarner and Bruce Bochy and Joe Panic.
Who are these people?
Don't make me school you on the San Francisco Giants, girl.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah, that's probably not the time for this.
In any case, let's get this CO2 thing started. I'm pretty excited about this topic myself. It's kind of the long-winded motivation for my own chemistry research. For those of you who don't know, I actually work on using electrochemistry to turn CO2 into products we can actually use, like chemicals and such. And every single one of my papers or presentations necessarily begins with some statement about how global CO2 concentrations are excessively high, they're causing all these problems, we need to do something about it, yada yada.
So this is the yada yada part.
I mean, technically it's all the details I have to skip over for the sake of time or word count. But I'm really excited we get to elaborate on it today.
Okay, let's kick things off with a little bit of trivia. Did you know that the warming of the climate caused by fossil fuel burning, aka CO2, was first estimated all the way back in 1896? Actually, the backstory seems really appropriate, since we've contextualized this with the Army War College Conference.
Post-World War II military research is what we have to thank for that initial interpretation. This research was conducted at Hanscom Air Force Base for the purpose of things like designing sensors for missiles that would find their targets based on heat.
I actually had no idea about all of this, by the way, and it's super interesting. Basically, these missiles were meant to detect the infrared radiation emitted by the engines of enemy bombers, and then, of course, target them. CO2 comes into play because these sensors would be ineffective if they were designed to detect certain wavelengths of the emitted radiation. Why, you might so logically ask?
Because certain wavelengths are quickly absorbed by molecules in the air, so the energy wouldn't be detected by the missile sensors, and the missiles wouldn't work right. And it'd all just be like this huge epic fail.
Again, dramatic much. let's not go critiquing the science behind the military's weaponry. The important point here is those molecules in the air. If you guessed that one example of them would be CO2, then I would say that you're quick on the uptake, and yes, CO2 is the key example here.
In our military case study, the CO2 absorbs part of the heat given off by enemy bomber engines and then collides with other molecules in the atmosphere, transferring that heat energy. The process continues and the atmosphere is warmed.
Now we can move away from the bomber example and talk about the Earth in general. Basically, the same principles apply. Heat generated on our planet, or heat from the sun that gets into our atmosphere, of course, gets trapped here by greenhouse gases like CO2. The more CO2, the better it's trapped.
That's why excess CO2, in both theory and practice, is a bad idea.
Something Dr. Ali does a lot in his paper, and I think would actually serve us well here today, is to explain why common arguments against the whole too much CO2 is bad concept really are not accurate. The first one we'll bring up then is the frequent claim that humans exhale CO2 literally all the time, so it can't be bad. It's part of the natural process of cellular respiration, naysayers say.
Of course, that's true, while the exhaling CO2 part. But the fact of the matter is that the amount of CO2 humans emit into the atmosphere far exceeds the amount that they breathe out. And okay, fine, cellular respiration is a natural thing, and we'll talk about photosynthesis, the part where plants take up atmospheric CO2, later on, but burning carbon-containing products, such as fossil fuels, is not natural and cannot be considered the same thing as breathing.
And now that Danielle is off her soapbox, we can put some numbers behind that to give you some context. The amount of CO2 released per person per year in the United States is about 38,000 pounds, and there are more than 323 million people in the US. Now, I'm sure that doesn't mean much to you at face value, but for reference, guess how many pounds of trash each person in the US generates per year?
It's gotta be higher than the CO2 total, right? I don't know, 50,000 pounds?
Do you even realize how big of a number that is? No, it's not that.
Okay, sorry, I tried.
Well, since you're trying to make a point, Cleo, I'm going to guess it's actually less than that CO2 amount.
Stop trying to outthink me.
Okay, well, how about 20,000 pounds?
Okay, well, even though you were trying to trick the system, you still lose. You were right about it being lower than the CO2 emissions total, but the quantity was still way off.
At least I didn't make every person out to be a human garbage truck like Daniela did.
Hey!
The real value is 1,000 pounds of trash per year per U.S. person.
So the CO2 emission statistic is 38 times more.
Exactly.
That is staggering.
I know. That's the CO2 that's warming the Earth.
And the CO2 being there and causing the warming really just starts a domino effect of other bad outcomes. For instance, water vapor, yeah, that's actually the biggest gaseous contributor to the greenhouse effect. And when CO2 causes the air to be warmer, more water is collected from the oceans as vapor in the atmosphere, thereby causing even more warming.
That's a great point, but I'm also glad you brought up water vapor because it's another common argument against global warming. Not the fact that having water vapor in the air is natural, because you can just go back to the humans breathing CO2 argument to refute that one. No, in this case, people who recall general chemistry often cite the fact that combustion reactions, aka igniting fuels,
remixed ignition, that's the words.
Oh my god.
But it's a great song.
Yeah, it is a great song. Anyway, these combustion reactions release water into the atmosphere.
God. Okay, I'm not going to pretend I remember that, but I'll trust you on this one since you're our resident chemistry queen. But in that case, I'm guessing that naysayers' argument is that water vapor is just as likely to be causing global warming as CO2.
Yeah, that's the gist. And it turns out that that can be refuted pretty definitively. According to Dr. Ali, the water vapor that enters the atmosphere from fossil fuel burning or other processes actually gets rained out of the atmosphere within a week's time. CO2 doesn't rain out of the sky once we put it there.
Acid rain?
No, that's a story for another day with its own set of problems.
No, I know, of course. I was just, you know, kidding. Anyway, the CO2 that gets emitted into the air can stick around for tens of thousands of years. So basically eternity.
Please don't you get all dramatic on me too.
Well, it seems like eternity.
Whether or not tens of thousands of years seems like eternity, that exact sort of timescale is actually used to tell us today what kind of climate changes we're expecting to see in the future. We're talking about climate models, of course. Critics of climate change often say that temperature changes are natural in the historical record. And before we talk about that any further, we do explain why historical fluctuations are most definitely not the case in episode 56 of the forum, so be sure to check that out.
Another related critique is that climate projections, often based on these historical data, have uncertainties, and that is actually a fact. As a result, unfortunately, some people actually think that governments are making up the climate change phenomenon.
Yeah, it's kind of taken on a conspiracy theory vibe in some circles.
But the point is that all the predictions say the same thing. Temperatures are increasing in a manner that's correlated with atmospheric CO2 levels. The only uncertainty that exists is the magnitude of that increase.
Doubts about the reality of climate change should truly be quelled by the fact that these projections are made by different researchers in different countries that have different funding sources, and their trend lines all agree. In other words, if climate change really was some conspiracy on the part of one government or another, the data simply wouldn't agree across the board.
But they do.
They do. Yeah, exactly. All the projections say, oh, your CO2 is going to be this high, never before seen level. Your temperatures are going to increase some number of degrees.
I mean, there are also people who say the models themselves just aren't accurate, even if they all agree.
True. So what does Dr. Ali say to those people?
Well, Dr. Ali tells those people that the projections about today's climate made decades ago using those models have now been shown to be accurate. Plus, as we've mentioned before on the show, using past data about volcanic eruptions and sun brightness and whatnot all results in an accurate so-called prediction of what happened in the historical record following those sorts of events.
So the climate modelers are the real fortune tellers here, and their crystal balls are pretty clear.
You could say that.
Well, kind of. We should definitely take the modeler's word, if that's what you're asking. But the truth is that a consistent problem with the models is that they underpredict climate changes. So they might spit out a projection of 5 degrees Celsius increase, but historically that's been low.
Great. So we should just take whatever number they give us for the coming decades and multiply it by some number.
No, that's not what I was going for with that.
And in the end, like Danielle said earlier, that CO2 that we know is causing warming is going to stick around in the atmosphere for a quote-unquote eternity.
Hey, I thought you said I was being dramatic.
Well, it can take around 100,000 years for CO2 in the atmosphere and oceans to be turned into new fossil fuels, so...
So I was right.
So you weren't wrong.
But that climate modeling discussion actually brings up another one of those naysayer comments. Yeah, I'm happy to get us back on track here. You're welcome.
It's normally my job, but I'll take your help today.
That argument is the fact that nature has undergone its own massive CO2 releases in the past. We're talking about the pre-human past. By this logic, our CO2 emissions shouldn't be that harmful.
But that one is so easy to poke holes in.
Oh, believe me, I know.
The short response to that one is that when nature did its CO2 spit-ups in the past...
That's what we're calling volcanic eruptions these days?
Whatever. Living things were harmed pretty darn badly.
The long response is one that outlines those pretty darn bad impacts. So, as an example... Dr. Ali mentions that 56 million years ago, a historical event known as the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum occurred. For those of you who aren't geological history buffs, this was basically the time when the Earth's climate was about 8 degrees Celsius warmer than it is today. During this time, nature released way more CO2 into the atmosphere than humans are even doing today, probably at the hands of a massive volcano-related event.
That event actually induced warming at a slower rate than humans are causing today. And the result was pretty incredible.
Bad incredible.
Right. Notable outcomes include the dwarfing of large warm-blooded animals, mass migrations, ecosystem disruptions, and extinctions, both at the local and global scale.
Oh yeah, no big deal. Totally.
Those are some pretty tangible historical impacts of a warming climate. And Dr. Ali warns that the costs of warming can increase really quickly. So more like exponential growth of impacts rather than linear. What he means by that is something like, I don't know, in the case of sea level rise, a little bit of rise might only cause nuisance flooding, maybe a couple inches of water in the basement. But a little more rise than that might escalate the situation to a relocation scenario. It's literally the real world equivalent of one of my favorite millennial phrases. Do you guys know which one?
I don't know. You have quite a few.
But Aubrey.
Okay, it's that escalated quickly.
And the sad thing is that that phrase can be applied to most warm temperature impacts.
Very true.
And all this brings us back to the photosynthesis point from earlier on in the show. Perhaps you've heard someone question how extra CO2 in the air could be bad if plants consume CO2. The conversation might have sounded something like this.
Don't plants need CO2 anyway? It sounds like CO2 emissions could be a good thing for the trees and for agriculture and for feeding the world's population.
Thank you, Daniela. It might have sounded something like that. The problem with that line of reasoning is that there's a good deal of scientific confusion about how much super high CO2 levels will actually help plants. As is the case with many other things in life, like cake, Star Wars, and the song Despacito, you can have too much of a good thing. Although, I would argue that maybe Despacito, there's no such thing as too much.
I also really like that song. But, okay. Basically, there is a chance that this CO2 could help plants, but there's also a chance that it could hurt them or have absolutely no effect.
Not to mention the fact that there are all the external outcomes of excess CO2 that could be super problematic for plants and other crops. So, for example, heat waves, droughts, flooding, or invasive pests themselves occurring due to heightened CO2 and warming, could threaten plants and the production of food crops.
So the net effect on plants seems like it would actually be negative. Heck, even if high CO2 could help plants, it seems like those other effects could hurt them enough that they'd never feel that beneficial effect.
Yeah, and that applies to CO2-related opportunities in general. If we're going to elicit any positive outcomes from high CO2 levels, it's going to require a bunch of interventions. Scientific, technological, regulatory, you name it.
Actually, Dr. Alley offered a really great analogy to hammer that point home.
Of course he did. He's great at explaining basically everything.
Okay, turn down the fangirl for a sec, Cleo.
Ugh, never. What's the analogy?
Okay, so the analogy is that building something valuable takes a lot of tools, but all it takes is a hammer to tear it down.
So in CO2 terms, exploiting any opportunities that might come with high CO2 levels would necessarily require a lot of the interventions Cleo mentioned before her fangirl sesh. But simply turning on the CO2 faucet is bound to cause a ton of problems.
That CO2 faucet has been running ever since fossil fuel burning became the norm. And let's face it, we need energy. Fossil fuels have been providing the world with energy for a really long time. But now we know that every drive to the beach or joyride in your dad's car has some long-term consequences that need to be dealt with deep into the future. So where do we turn for our energy needs?
Straight out the kitchen.
Renewables, of course.
Wow, I'm starting to really enjoy listening to Daniela sing on our show.
beautiful.
We really appreciate it. The good news is that shifting away from a fossil fuel-based economy over the coming years is expected to have both environmental and economic benefits. You've heard it before, and you're going to hear it here. Sustainable, renewable energy sources are the future, both because of emissions reduction targets and because fossil fuels are finite.
Of course, technologies already exist that will help in this clean energy transition. But there's always room for improvements, and science and engineering advancement could definitely help fill the gap. So that means research projects with implications for clean energy will need full support, both ideologically and financially.
This is starting to get into the policy side of things now. So aside from supporting research and development of renewable energy tech, what policy options should we be discussing here?
Well, there's really one that's key to Dr. Alley's entire paper here.
One? Seriously? Has that ever happened on our show before?
Maybe not, but it's one that you may have heard about before in today's case, so it's definitely worth clarifying. The policy that needs to be adopted here, according to Dr. Alley, is, quote, a rational carbon tax.
Recent findings from the International Monetary Fund, or the IMF, and International Energy Agency claim that subsidies for fossil fuels in the United States and around the world are pretty big, and they vastly exceed analogous subsidies for renewable energy. Societal damages that come from fossil fuel burning, like all the ones we've discussed here today, plus all the other ones we've spent countless episodes on, just aren't incorporated into the price of fossil fuels in most locations.
A carbon tax is basically one that tries to put a price on, well, carbon. It tries to take into account all of those outcomes and damages that we associate with CO2 emissions. It's hoped, of course, that such a tax could result in decreased fossil fuel consumption and thus lower emissions.
Economists have a range of ideas about how aggressive such a tax should be to accomplish these important goals. But in general, many economists do think that taxing carbon could slow global warming while actually boosting the economy.
Per Dr. Ali's paper, it seems that most economists also favor internationally harmonized carbon prices as opposed to different policies in all different corners of the world. But alas, that would be an enormous step. And until such a step is made, some places actually have instituted their own carbon taxes.
For example, the United Kingdom has had a carbon tax in place since 2013, although it could more strictly be considered as a, quote, carbon price floor, because it defines the minimum amount that fossil fuel producers are required to pay for CO2 emissions.
Australia enacted a carbon tax in 2012 and repealed it 2 years later. While it existed, it was pretty monumental because it was the first explicit national carbon tax, according to the source carbontax.org.
And Chile passed the first carbon tax in South America back in 2014. The established price is pretty modest, but it'll start taking effect this year, 2018.
Very cool. So precedent exists here for these sorts of carbon taxes, and as more and more are instituted, we'll truly see how effective they are at lowering fossil fuel consumption while simultaneously helping decrease emissions. Will more countries follow suit? Time will tell.
All right, well, if it's time that will tell, I guess it's time we wrap things up.
Sounds good to me.
Okay, so today we took another deep dive into the climate change conversation by examining the relationship between carbon dioxide emissions and global temperature increases. We've also taken a look at common skepticisms about CO2-induced warming and explained why each of them can be dismissed in turn.
In summary, temperature increases strongly correlate with atmospheric CO2 levels, and historical precedent has taught us that we can only expect poor outcomes as a result. In order to curb emissions, it may be time to take a closer look at the efficacy of existing carbon taxes around the world. Do they truly decrease fossil fuel consumption? Do renewable energy sources need more subsidy-based encouragement? Or are they taking over all on their own?
We'd love to hear your thoughts on these topics and more over on our social media channels. Communicate with us on Twitter at ISGPForum or on Facebook at facebook.com/ISGPForum. We want to know your take on renewables and the price of carbon.
And Daniela's singing skills and the song Remix to Ignition. No, that was awesome, Dee. Thanks for that. As always, we hope all of you enjoyed today's episode and that you'll be back with us in 2 weeks' time for our next one. Thank you so much for socializing with science today, and we'll catch you next time right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.